Mr. Bunnell, whom we knew as Judge Bunnell, and our families were very close. And we played with Jean as she was younger, a couple of years. But we all played little dolls together, and we grew up together. So Bunnell was telling me, he said, you know, those two boys, they came in here when they were going to sign up, and they said like this. They shook their finger, and they said to me, now, Bunnell, we've been kicked out of a whole lot better colleges than you have here. So they had kind of a rocky time, but
that was Bob McComb.
That was Bob and John McComb.
And they went to McGill.
Yeah, well, they were kicked out of McGill, and they were kicked out of the colleges that had quite a little.
Are they Canadian?
They were Canadians.
From Dorval, Quebec.
Yeah.
Quebec. And they were remittance men. They had funds from home.
They were the only ones that had funds.
Right. Clifford
Smith had a little bit, and he had a little pocketbook that you opened with a pinch, and he had money that his parents, the Iceman, Murray Smith, would give him, but the rest of us were all working our way through.
Ethel Bailey, too, I guess.
Ethel didn't work her way through. She had some money, that's right.
She had some money.
Because
now, you were telling about working for the railroad, Art.
Yeah.
You earned money there, and then you earned money cutting hair at the university.
And cutting 4-foot wood on the birch on the hill right back of the school, dead.
For fuel birch. At the school?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have a lovely...
driving and taxiing.
Do you remember that?
Right. You
and hauling
that
coal up to the school, too.
Holy smoke.
We have an ad that one of the students...
Dindy Moore.
Gave to you to pay for some of the taxi fare that he didn't pay you. And we have it to this day, which must go to the archives. It's the to and from taxi service that he has. To and fro taxi service with all of this.
Yeah, that would look cute.
Yeah, we've got to give that to them.
That's clever.
Yeah.
That's a real
And thing. Then after we were married, somebody else, my brother-in-law, who is now my sister's husband before, took over this taxi, and Herschel Landrieu, you know Herschel Landrieu, Buck Landrieu?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he was teaching out here, didn't teach very long. So he called our house. He wanted to go out by taxi, but Art wasn't driving taxi then, and I remember you had to get out of bed to answer that, and you laid poor Herschel out to a fare you well.
Oh, and I don't make it too strong.
You were pretty bad. You scared him to death. But there's another thing. I never thought of that. It has to go to the archives because that's from...
to and fro text.
Yes, sir, and that's from about 1924.
Yeah.
He was quite artistic, and he...
but he didn't pay his bills.
Well, there's a number of them are artistic.
Well, you were... What did you do?
I gave music lessons.
Piano lessons.
Mm-hmm. Now, we'd go to school. We had to walk to the railroad depot, and you got in that little car that Art Marsh drove to the foot of College Hill, and then you walked up College Hill. Now, we had coal stoves. My mother was dead by then, and you'd have to start those fires before we went to school. We had to catch that little car at 7:30, and you really didn't get your... house very warm, you know. You started out pretty cold. Well, then I'd come home and I'd go to the people's houses to teach. Then I'd come get home. I went to school half a day, 5 days. And I'd come home and be dark and cold, and the house would be so dark, and somehow or other my inefficient father, who was a Californian, which meant that he wasn't very practical, and an attorney, which meant he was doubly not practical. So the light switch, you walked the whole length of the living room to the dining room to turn it on. I was just sure there was somebody in there going to get me every time. But I'd get in and get that light turned on. Then you'd have to empty the ashes to start the fire, to thaw some water, melt it, and heat it up so you could wash the breakfast dishes so you could cook your dinner.
Oh, dear.
You know, when I look, and none of us thought a thing about it.
That house was cold as a tent. There was nothing overhead for insulation. The roof was just galvanized iron and boards.
Is that right?
Well, Dad was so impractical. He thought if he would paper, he papered around the 2x4s because he got 6 inches more headroom upstairs. But between us and 60 below, there was nothing but corrugated iron and paper, and it wasn't certainly enough. We were cold all our lives, but we didn't know it. But my mother did.
Yeah.
My mother suffered
she
all
really
of
must have suffered.
And she was over 40, you know, and she was too old for this sort of thing. And the toilets outdoors for a while. You had the scavenger come, and you did have, but we didn't when we were going to college because, well, it was another expense.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, we walked to school, and we lived on 2nd Avenue where the dentist, what is the dentist up there that bought our house? It's up on 2nd between Dunkel and Hall. Anyway, you know about how far that would be to walk
mm-hmm.
to the station, and then we walked the railroad. And I'm tall and Art's tall, and we were going together. And we got so we could walk, we could take two ties. You got that cadence,
yeah.
And you kind of loped. We walked, not for pleasure, we walked to save 25 cents round trip fare.
2 bits a round trip.
Yes, right? 2 bits a round trip. And we walked a great deal.
Well, you gave piano lessons.
Yes, yes. I had taken lessons from Mr. Gobra. And
I was going to ask you.
Mr. Gobra.
Is he the teacher the Russ girls were talking about?
No, I took lessons from this Otto Hoppe. But my mother was home all the time, and she realized that he wasn't for her little girls. We were with him not too long. And then my father was a good friend of Mr. Gobra, who, very interesting man. He left Germany in 1885, came to this country, played in the Metropolitan Opera House, played with Victor Herbert and Pat Gilmore's band. Then he was a trumpeter and French horn player. Then he had a type of paralysis somewhat of one side of his lip. And he said, Dorothy, I would never play second fiddle to myself if he couldn't be as good as he had been. So in 1898, he decided to come to the Klondike.
Mm-hmm.
And the lush, plush living of a musician in New York, he left that life. Crossed Canada, went over the Dyea Trail, built his boat on the lake shore.
Mm-hmm.
Never done anything but a musician and a
yeah.
crack musician.
And sheltered life, probably.
Yes. So he left New York weighing 212 pounds. He hit Dawson City weighing 157. Never found any gold. But he played in all the dance halls and played
mm-hmm.
for all the entertainment in early Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
So my father coaxed him. Then he came here. He drove a horse from Dawson when this country was struck, you see. Drove from Dawson and the Winter Trail to here and mined and played in the dance halls and things like that. Then they coaxed him to have a band. And I have one of those early day pictures of the band that Ed B. Davis's brother gave me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one that must go to the archives. Maybe nobody has it but I. And so my father wanted us to have music. We had the little phonograph with the big horn on it, and
yeah.
we had all the best records. The Metropolitan Opera Stars, Schumann Haiken, Calvet, and Sembrich and Caruso and Scotty, all of these fabulous people. So we knew them, and we had the books on the opera. And Mr. Gobra never had taught piano, didn't play piano, so he taught us as an orchestra leader would conduct an orchestra.
Oh, I see.
It was quite a fabulous background, and he had been in the Metropolitan when Schumann Haidt made her debut and things like this. Well,
mm-hmm.
the stories he told. Now, when he was in Germany as a small boy going to the conservatory, he heard Franz Liszt play his own
mm.
compositions. He heard the Waltz King,
Strauss
conduct his own waltzes. So he was fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
Just fabulous.
He must have had a wonderful experience just being
with him.
And
that's
probably
right.
A much better background or appreciation for music.
Fabulous.
Now,
not the mechanics of playing.
Mr. Hoppe, they were talking about today, was the strict band leader swatted him on.
And he hated everything.
And
but
they all hated him
They feared him. Yeah.
And the Russ girls were talking about,
uh-huh.
they took piano lessons from
for
Hoppe.
7 years.
And they feared him, and they hated it,
yes.
and none of them have appreciated music.
No.
How about Charlotte Ames? Where did she study music?
She took a little from Mr. Gobra. Mr. Gobra said she could have been fabulous. She just had it innately.
She is wonderful.
She's wonderful.
She's just one of those wonderful Alaskans.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And she was a musician for the Auxiliary until
she's great.
2 years ago.
She's great. And her dance music is out of this world.
She goes to Pioneer Home and plays for the little parties or big parties. Yeah. And she sits there and just plays away and can play anything.
Anything,
It's wonderful.
Now, we have a son that also took for Mr. Gobra for a little while. And he does the same thing. Anything you want. Because then he took at the University of Oregon, and so he knows the mechanics of piano playing, such as we really did learn. But Marie Cork Fate took from Mr. Gobra too, and the Fates just love these stories of Mr. Gobra too. But that was a privilege, and another privilege, the fact that Mother kept us so very closely at home. All we did was read. I read the Catholic Priest Library. I read the Episcopal Library. I read the the Thomas Library. I read John Clark, the attorney's library. So I have read things that nobody that I know of has ever had time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they would let me take all I could carry home in the real cold weather when we knew it wasn't going to be open. Well, who else has read all of Bulwer Lytton? Nearly everybody's read The Last Days of Pompeii, but who has read the two volumes of The Last of the Barons? All of these that this library had, because this was underwritten by Trinity Church in New York.
Mm-hmm.
They shipped these marvelous books and magazines in, and every miner and every prospector could take a gunny sack of books out with them for free. Those were circulated and passed around.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Charlie McGonning, who was such a long-time friend of ours, that was in that 1909 mountain climb, the miners' climb to disprove Captain Cook, he hadn't gone past the fourth grade. But he was vastly well-read.
Probably had a marvelous education.
Because of these books that were passed around. Now, that is one of the things that must have saved the sanity of many, many people.
Oh, of course.
Because
yeah.
I'd rather be a little bit hungry than not have nothing to read.
Yeah.
So, in a way, it's a background. Nobody can ever have this background again because we have the radio and we have airplane. But we were totally isolated here.
There probably was no other family, and maybe there were. You're probably a very unique family in Fairbanks.
We were, because Mother kept us very, very closely at home.
They're just the two daughters.
Just the two daughters. Mm-hmm. And we were protected so. And when Mother died very unexpectedly, the whole town protected us. If we had wanted to go out and cut a wingding, we would have never been allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
We were the Roth girls, and there were, believe me, there wasn't any other place to go but to be the Roth girls, you see.
And when did your mother die and how?
Well, Mother died of pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
She died in 23, didn't she?
She must have been about 23,
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And we met this darling old Indian when I went to the luncheon at the Senior Citizens. And I like the Native people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went over, and they knew me. And this one, Laura Alford, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she said to me, "Oh, I know you. You're the daughter of Judge Roth. When I go to my cabin, I pass your mother's grave every day, Ada Roth." You know, I was so touched, I could hardly keep from crying. And she remembered stopping when Jean Bunnell lived there on Fifth, when she was here, and she remembered Florence and myself being with Jean Bunnell. Well, all these things are touching to me.
Yes.
And she, her family was up the Yannick River in the spring of 22, actually, first of the year. And my brother Jewel went over and visited them. They lived in a tent. I didn't go over. Jewel brought him some sheep meat and took back some caribou meat.
And she remembered that. She said, "I knew your husband's brother, Jewel Loftus, in 1921. So it's 21, because she wouldn't be wrong. And Art came up here before working on the railroad, finishing the railroad. He was fishing in the Bering Sea in 1920 on a two-masted schooner. So he's had a lot of lives, too.
Well, when did you come then? Was that your first trip to Alaska in 1920?
Fishing
codfish.
I got ashore at Port Mahler. We had to get a gasket for the engine to raise the anchor. It was blown out.
He was just in the Bering Sea.
Well, that's all I got in Alaska.
Except the Bering Sea.
20.
But you, how did you leave Minnesota?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, excuse me.
On the freight.
But why did you leave?
Well, we heard they made $3,000 fishing salmon in the Bristol Bay around there.
During the season?
In the season. So we grabbed the freight. We had nothing in our budget for transportation, so
Who's we? You and your brother?
A neighbor kid, Clarence Iceberg and I. Passenger engines part of the time at night, and freights the rest of the time. Got to Seattle, and it was too early for the salmon season. So they were going cod fishing about that time, so we got on this little two-masted schooner. It had 200 tons of rock salt in the hold for ballast and salting the fish.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent 5 months on the whole trip. We were 30 days to Unimak Pass from Seattle, because there were becalm 12 days and head winds. There was a poor sailor, it was a lumbering craft and a two-mast schooner, and it couldn't gain much on a head wind, it drifts so much. And Unimak Pass was just a jumble of wind, so we couldn't sail through, we just drifted through with the tide. And we were 5 months on the whole trip. We went back in 17 days, we had fair winds. I didn't do too well. I made $350 plus clothes, and food was furnished.
It's far cry from the 3,000.
Yeah, and my two brothers were sort of strike breakers in a sense in the Chicago freight yards that summer. There was sort of an illegal strike, so employers, young fellows, went all over in Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin and hired high school kids to work the Chicago freight yards. There's a lot of employees there. And they got a dollar an hour and a dollar and a half overtime, and they could put in all the overtime they wanted. Well, they came home with $1,500, which didn't last quite as long as my $350 with Jewel. I went to Sweeney Auto School 6 weeks, and then Jewel had put in a semester at the University of Wisconsin, went broke and hoboed down to Kansas City, and I was sitting on the by the window out on the sidewalk eating my lunch, and Jewel came around the corner and says, "Hi, kid, let's go to Alaska." So we got kicked off of three freights trying to get out of Kansas City because the railroad man had been pushed off of a boxcar by a tramp and drowned in a borrow pit.
Uh-huh.
They were very nasty to hobos then, so we hiked out 10 miles and got a freight at a crossing. And it was fun bumming to Seattle with Jewel because everything was funny, laughing all the time.
And that little bit of Sweeney Auto School got you on the CAT in Broadpast and let you help finish the railroad and let you come into town and get to the university.
And what was the school?
Sweeney Auto School. He trained mechanics for the Army in the First World War.
And where was the school located?
Kansas City, Missouri, Kansas City. Right across from the Union Station.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you got your training in operating machinery.
Well, we just theory of the gasoline engine, reciprocating engine, and the carburation and the ignition. We learned about coils and magnetos. So I had enough confidence to talk my way into this job. The present driver of this tractor was kind of ornery. The Teamsters hate him because he'd crowd him off the road, not wait for turnout. The road, the snow was 10 feet high there in March on the level. And they had to use the turnouts to pass the Teamsters.
And he wasn't very...
He wasn't cooperative, so there was hard feelings, and I guess he was homesick. He wanted to leave anyhow. So I got...
You got the job.
I got eight months, 180 a month and board the two first months, and then 225 a month the next 6 months. And I was told the resident engineers fed themselves and just got 180 a month. So I felt...
You were doing pretty well.
I was doing fine for a kid.
You bet.
And I was buying 80 acres back in Wisconsin at that time, making payments on it, which I sold my oldest brother in 26 and got a Chevrolet touring car and headed back
for Fairbanks.
That's
the one you brought up for the taxi.
Yeah, I left Fairbanks. Asked Jennings how I could hobo out. He says, "Well, see Prosser in Seward. And he'll introduce you to the steward, and they'll get you aboard. Cost you about $20, he says. So that's the way it worked out. I guess Prosser got 10.
On a freight?
Yeah.
No, this was on the
steamship. Oh, passenger ship hauling freight. And Prosser got 10, I guess the steward got 10, and I lived down in the steerage. Well, they searched the ship 3 times for a couple of bank robbers from Ketchikan. They found one kid and balled the daylights out of him and put him to polishing brass. And one time they searched it, I was in Dorothy's dad's room. He was going out to promote his coal property up to Healy.
Did you know him?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I was living in his cabin next to their house. He invited me to use the empty cabin.
And he and my father and I were feuding for my time, which was because my father had all call on my time, and somehow or other I was kind of a little bit interested in a little time with Art, you see. But then my dad, of course, had a stateroom, and instead of Art being in the bowels of the ship, steerage,
he was up in the stateroom.
Yeah, with Dad.
Yeah. And another time the search party came by, I was up on the bridge close to the officers, and they passed me up. And the third time, I was in the top bunk down in the steerage, and I heard the search party talking and coming. Now, the ship's officers must have known I was a stowaway, and I just shrunk down into that mattress as deep as I could under the blankets, and they walked right by. I'm sure I showed from a distance there's a little hump on the bed. If they wanted to find me, they could have found me.
They knew you were a deserving young man.
So... Then I asked the steward, if I could go ashore at Juneau. And she said, sure, it's all right, but don't come aboard till I come out down to the gangplank and pass you by. So there I stood, leaning. The first whistle had blown. Another 15 minutes, she was leaving, I guess, and I stood leaning up against a warehouse there, kind of worried, ready for the last whistle, and picking up the gangplank. And the last moment, the steward ran down, and I hustled up and went aboard then.
But he, what was he, did he check you for?
He had passed him a little money, you see, to pass him by, so he got a little of the money in his own pocket.
He must have gotten $10 out of that 20 from Prosser.
Mm-hmm.
And there I got feed and board, and he got $10 for letting me by, and I wonder if the ship's officers above him must have known I was a stowaway.
Well, how about Mr. Roth? Did he help you out with a little food now and then? Or?
Oh, I'm sure he did.
I ate some oranges in his, room. But I had plenty of grub. I ate with the workmen, with the sailors down in the steerage.
Mm-hmm.
There was plenty of grub.
That was a strange thing. My father had coal property up beyond Cap Lathrop. And if had he been a realist, he would have known nobody could fight Cap Lathrop. It was excellent coal, what they call cannel coal. But he was this optimistic dreamer. So that my mother died, and he was going to hand us the world in a silver platter, my sister and myself. So he took these coal samples out in the most beautiful pigskin suitcase.
Steamer trunk.
Me protesting all the time because we didn't have anything nice like that. Now, sweetheart, I have to make a good impression. And even I knew there was something wrong with taking coal out in a beautiful pigskin.
I'm sure I protested a little, too.
And he said, I'll be back in 3 months. Now, Florence and I had led the most protected lives that any two little girls ever could have. I was then 18, but still a very untried 18. My father left to be back in 3 months. He never came home. About 9 months after that, I had a call from Mr. Labry, Bailey, and he said, well, Dorothy, what are you going to do about your father's rent? I said, rent? I guess maybe I didn't know people paid rent for offices, you know. My dad didn't do anything about the rent. He hadn't turned off his phone. So I paid the phone bill. And you don't get much teaching music, you know. Really, you don't. And going to school. But I paid the phone bill, and I talked to Labry and Bailey. I said, well, I don't know what I can do. The best I can do for you is to give you my father's law library and his furniture. Because by that time, my dad had gotten interested in some oil leases out there. He thought he was going to make a million in oil.
In California.
He could... This was, he'd just forgotten all about this life up here entirely, and I never saw him again.
Oh, he was.
Never saw him again.
He was also interested in a rotary gasoline engine with three or four ports around the rim, just like a grindstone revolving with ports and explosion chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Dudley brothers, and we sent him $60 to pay for the patent.
And that was a lot of money for
us. And we saw a wooden model of it on El Segundo when we were there.
But when I look back on it, you'd have thought we would have been frightened to death. But somehow or other, nothing, you know.
But
just,
you had no idea that he
wasn't coming back. No, but we see. I never made a dime. Neither my then Bunnell gave Florence when she started out there. She was his secretary mm-hmm. for a while, and she during the summer would conduct tourists. And we managed, all very well, you know. There wasn't any money, and I'll tell you, our clothes, as Art has told about that skirt, he said it was more darns. I was very clever. It was a plaid skirt. So I got the yarn to darn it in the right colors, and I wasn't aware I was so shabby. Art said, I'd just give anything if we save that skirt for posterity.
Yeah, I can see that skirt like yesterday. It was black and green, checkered, and nothing but darning through.
And very neatly darned, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But it's a terrific background. I could never be lonely a day in my life because there's too many things that... Too many interesting things that we've lived through.
Life has got so many interesting things to do. I can't imagine where, for example, a friend of mine invited me to go to the lake today.
Uh-huh.
Because one of the women out there was having an all-day and all-night bridge.
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Which is fine for people mm-hmm. who have the time to do it. But I have too many things to do.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I've never mm-hmm. learned to play bridge. And when I lived at Barrow, when we had lots and lots of time,
mm-hmm.
I used to knit. I'd do things. Mm-hmm. I'd try to be producing. Mm-hmm. I didn't read as much as I should mm-hmm. have then. But I never have read very much. My husband is the reader in the family.
We have a fabulous library at home, about 4,000 books. We have some fabulous Alaska books.
Oh,
really, really interesting things.
Yeah. I think bridge is a living death.
We have the complete set of Bancroft histories, which are very hard to find. It's and everything.
Could you save some of your father's library, or did he have just legal?
That was just law library.
Law library.
My father and mother had a wonderful library outside, but I didn't get outside for 40 years, and I couldn't say to this old aunt, "I want my father's books." She gave them to a daughter because she said she had two marvelous things. She had this beautiful diamond for one daughter, granddaughter, and all these books.
Who was that?
Aunt Barbara.
Oh, Barbara.
I couldn't. I would like to have gotten those books because I think I might have known my mother and father as adults.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't do that. 40 years, you see. I didn't feel they were mine. So what we have now, and it's a great collection, is our own collecting. You mm-hmm. see, we're making our own things to pass to our own, which in a way maybe is a very good thing.
To get back to the university now, the three Loftus, were you the only Loftus brother?
The first day. The first day, the other two came later. There was Roden Davis and Art and Earl Foster and
Ethel Bailey
and Donald Morgan and myself.
So there were six of you.
Six of us. And Donald Morgan was the other one that didn't have to work off anything bonehead because he had a good academic background here. And then the others drifted in. And the way Art got to school was because we started going together. And the first time I ever saw Art, you knew Andy Davis, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There was a dance. I was just out of high school, and Edby came up to me. And Edby was the kind that, you see, were 10 fellows to every girl, and Edby's the kind that you would always say to him, well, the way you wrote your name on my program, I just couldn't read it. And you'd always shuffle him off, till maybe he'd catch you on an extra if you weren't pretty fast stepping.
See? He must have been a poor dancer, eh?
Well, yeah, and he was poor everything. You know, I mean, yes. But anyway, he came up to me and he said, Dorothy, I have a friend He's a poor dancer, but he's a fine fellow. And I thought, oh, if Andy says he's a poor dancer, what am I going to do with him? Well, that was my second heart.
I looked in the power plant door and I got talking with Edby. That's all I got.
And he was kind and
that's
good.
That's how he met Art.
Yeah. Well, then I was going to school. There was never any thought that Florence and I wouldn't go on to school, you see. Yeah. So Art decided, well, he'd go to school. Well, then when he went to school, his two brothers came in from, and they decided they'd go to school. Now, none of those three Loftuses would have gone to school if I hadn't just, my father hadn't just assumed I was going out to college. Yeah.
All right, we'll give you full credit.
I want credit. That's all I can get. There'll be no cash. It'll all be credits.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
I think that's 22. I was up to Salt Jacket with Gobro prospecting, and then I wanted to start school. Was that 22?
That's right, 22. That's right.
And it was too early. The hole was sloughing in. The gravel was thawing. Gobro says, I have to wait till it gets cold. So I found some old lumber on No Grub Creek and made a little boat in a day and a half and floated down 70 miles to Munson's, they called it, 40 miles out. And I got to school.
Well, now in 1922, that was the fall of 1922.
Yes, that was September.
So the first graduate was Shanley.
Jack Shanley in 23. That is correct. And the next one was Margaret Murray. Was it Jamie Cameron? Jamie Cameron, wasn't she the second?
I don't remember.
But Jamie Cameron came from Hawaii, and she went to school here, and she brought, and then her brother came. And shall I tell you an awfully cute story?
Wait a minute. Here comes another cute story in a paper. I wanted to get that
dear.
Going to the bathroom bit, but I didn't quite get it all.
Oh, dear.
I just read Margaret Murray's...
Two in the Far North? Mm-hmm. Well, we're the Roth girls that are mentioned there. So.
I know.
And Marty was 3 or 4 years ahead of me. And Margaret is a beautiful woman.
I met her at Clara Russ.
Yes.
Some years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
beautiful.
6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful.
I met her husband, too.
Olus.
I met her while she was there.